concert billboard is also found online at WUSB.FM, where you can find out what's scheduled in the upcoming months so you can plan ahead. WUSB Stony Brook, 90.1 FM and WUSB.FM.
And this is radio station WUSB Stony Brook. Time is 6:02. Time once again for Off the Wall. Thank you. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening. Yes, indeed. And where to begin? Well, we can go a couple of different ways on this program. We can point to the positive, or we can focus on the negative. I think we're going to do a little bit of both. What I just did now, in the extra time. Oh, that's nice. That's very nice. I wish. I don't know why we have such a huge monitor here. It's so big and so nice, but it's a radio station and nobody can see it except me. But right now, what I just did, I just made full screen the video from Jet Propulsion Laboratories, JPL. In fact, what I also did, I created a tiny URL so everybody else can go and look at it now without having to type an incredibly long URL. If you go to tinyurl.com/JPL-curiosity, JPL-curiosity, I assume you know how to spell that, you can see this video. And this video actually has been around for a number of months. It details just what exactly the Mars expedition, the rover now known as Curiosity, is doing, has done. And it does all this without words. You just see it. The film itself is a monumental achievement, I think. If we just made the film, I'd say that's pretty cool. But not only did these guys make the film, but they actually sent this object into space where it landed. Landed early Monday morning, our time. And did everything it was supposed to do. I'm watching it now. It's deploying a parachute, and which slows it down incredibly. And a piece of it falls off. And then it detaches from the parachute at the very same moment that jets fire to to bring this thing up from crashing into the ground. And then it slowly lowers itself onto the Martian surface, or towards the Martian surface. And then the rover, before it actually touches the surface, the rover is lowered through what looked like bungee cords. And it's very carefully placed on the ground. And at the moment it touches the ship that is lowering it, basically hurtles away into the distance and crash lands somewhere else. And the reason they had to do it this way was because this rover is so incredibly big compared to the other ones, and so filled with potential scientific experiment setups, I guess laboratories, on it, that no other rover has had the capability of. And so there it is. They were able to do all of this from Earth. And if you watch the video, which again, tinyurl.com/JPL-curiosity, it's 11 minutes long, and right now we're just at the part where it lands. It's going to do all kinds of other things after it lands, as far as just moving around and taking samples and analyzing the samples and basically teaching us an awful lot about the planet that's most similar to Earth. And, you know, I was watching this. I was connected to NASA TV, which anybody can do just by going to NASA.gov and clicking on the video feed. And just watching the engineers as they were getting news bit by bit, almost literally, from space, knowing that parachute deployment had succeeded, that Curiosity was still in touch. It was so incredibly emotional. And, you know, looking at that, watching all these people, all these geeks in a room, seeing the emotion on their faces, realizing the incredible work they've done to make this happen. Unlike what I suspect to most other people, I say to myself, that's where I want my tax dollars to go. All of them, if necessary. But, you know, it just frustrates me so much because there are way too many people in my life, and I imagine in yours as well, who think the whole thing's a big waste of time. Who think exploration of the unknown It's a waste of time. And these are people on the left, on the right, doesn't matter. Old, young, it boggles my imagination. In fact, it's an insult to my imagination that people believe this. People believe we have to solve every single problem back on Earth before we can do anything in space. Yet where are they when so many more of their tax dollars go towards invading countries and building bombs and building airplanes? They don't protest at all. They just dutifully pay their taxes every year because, well, what can they do? But when NASA does something different, then the debate starts as to, well, what could we do differently? I prefer my tax dollars to go to this instead. I just wish the conversation was had on a much higher level, where 99% of the money goes. You know, somebody posted a statistic. I don't doubt this. It sounds like something that actually makes a lot of sense. The amount of the bank bailout in the last few years, that amount that was basically given to banks, is more than the entire NASA budget in the entire history of NASA. Yeah, no, not just the entire NASA budget. The entire NASA budget times 50, because that's how long they've been around for. I think it's 50 years. If you add up every dollar they have ever gotten, it is less than what the banks got only a couple of years ago. That should put it in perspective. There's all kinds of other things you can do to put it in perspective. But it's misplaced idealism when people think that, well, we could spend our money better and not live out dreams and build new technology and explore things. Let's apply that idealism to, you know, something that will save some lives. You know, if we didn't live in such a war-obsessed nation, maybe we wouldn't be living in such poverty. And yeah, we do live in poverty. Look at every city in this nation. Look at the inner cities. Look at the state of our healthcare, the state of our roads, the state of our railways, non-existent railways too. Look at all that, and tell me we're thriving. We're not thriving because we waste so much on meaningless adventures. Whereas what we saw Sunday night was a very meaningful adventure, and something that the whole future of the human race rests on things like this. And I only hope that it leads to many, many more. I'm watching Curiosity now, of the artist rendering of Curiosity, this giant robot that'll wander around Mars and take it all in. And one day humans will do such a thing too, as we've discussed on this program. One day humans will head to the red planet and do God knows what. But that's what we're meant to do. We're meant to explore. I am just blown away, though, that this can actually happen, that we can do things like this, that there are people with minds so advanced that they can control little objects millions and millions of miles away and make them operate with incredible precision and also predict exactly to the second what time something's going to happen, unlike anything here on Earth. Yeah, they knew it was going to land at 1:31 a.m. Eastern Time. You know, the train from Port Jefferson can't even leave at the time it's scheduled to leave, and that's the first stop. It doesn't take much to make it leave when it's supposed to leave, but no, they can't do that. But when you send a space probe to Mars, yeah, you better get it right. You better get it to the second. That's what science is all about. So, yeah, it's frustrating and annoying. To have this debate constantly just to justify the existence of programs that explore our neighboring worlds. And that to me is the most important thing that that we can be doing. But then science, I guess, is the big enemy of a lot of things around us. It tells people things they don't want to hear. All right. Here's an update from BBC. NASA has used one of its satellites to image the Curiosity rover on Mars. The picture shows not only the six-wheeled vehicle, but also all the components of its discarded landing system. It's pretty incredible. They have an actual satellite up there orbiting Mars that can relay pictures and take pictures of what's going on the surface involving technology from Earth. Now, the items that have been photographed or transmitted include the heat shield, the parachute, and back shell of the entry capsule, and the sky crane that lowered the rover to the surface. The image was acquired by the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter from 300 kilometers and at an oblique angle of 41 degrees. A signal confirming the Curiosity rover, which is also known as the Mars Science Lab, had landed on Mars, the signal, that is, was received at Mission Control at JPL at 5:32 Greenwich Mean Time, which I guess is, 1:32 Monday morning. They were supposed to land at 1:31, so I guess they got the signal at that time. The robot put down at the base of a deep depression known as Gale Crater, and the first hours on the surface have been spent checking out the health of the vehicle, retrieving some early engineering pictures that tell the mission team about the location where Curiosity landed. And, the first few images were thumbnails, black and white thumbnails. Yeah, look pretty crude. But much bigger color pictures are on the way. And pictures are just one tiny bit of the story. It's really incredible that that we're at this stage. You know, I'm just impatient that we weren't at this stage 20 years ago. And I'm sorry, this is either we won another gold medal or it's something more important than that. Okay, that's actually a message from a voice that you will find familiar. Hang on. Okay, there we go. I have to rebuild the studio every week I come in here. Right, do I have a dial tone? Not good. Okay. We're giving Kyle a call in Seattle, and I know he's been a big proponent of the space program. That really sounds far away, doesn't it?
Hello?
Kyle. Oh, I'm getting another message. This is Emmanuel from Off the Wall calling you. We just got a text message from you.
Oh, good. I'm glad to know that all that stuff's working.
That technology, by the way, probably comes about through previous space missions. I just went on a long rant about the space missions and how worthwhile they are and how clueless people are who criticize them. That was pretty much the extent of it.
Yeah, well, if it isn't directly supported by space technology, it probably has technologies that support it in some way, like GPS or whatnot, that have also helped in its development.
You know, I've had such trouble, and I don't know, it's kind of weird. Here I am at a major university. Of course, I haven't really polled the students here, but, you know, amongst the people I know, I've had such trouble finding enthusiasm about this. Instead, I just get kind of like, this cynical outlook of things are horrible here on Earth, and, my life sucks, and this is just a big waste of time. And I was just pointing out the hypocrisy of just applying that to missions of science and exploration and not to the actual destructive missions where the vast majority of money is thrown away.
Right. Well, it just seems like we spend way too much of it on ice cream and, silly stuff like that and like war making, and we don't do much more research to find out, like, what other things are out there and what's possible. And I don't know, space still, it, like, gets me pretty excited, and hopefully people in the listening area will be as excited. And I think the Curiosity milestone really did a lot for people's imaginations and potential new projects and reasons for people to get excited.
Yeah, I sure hope so. You know, the thing that bugged me was that they said if this mission failed, that it was going to deeply affect the future of NASA, period. And, you know, what pressure to put on these poor guys that you got to succeed or that's it, you're done, rather than learning from mistakes and treating failure as just another reason to keep going back.
Yeah, and to speak to your previous point, like, we never say that about the military. If they fail, it's like, all right, guys, what do you need next year?
Yeah, really. I mean, we lost Vietnam, right? We pretty much lost Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, should we disband the military? You know, let's put that up for a vote. But instead, we live in this, like, version of North Korea where we idolize the military, give them whatever they want. They have everything. We have very little. And, you know, yeah, we have more than other places. But things around us are not as good as they should be. They're crumbling. We're forced to live in situations that really are not fair, and we spend way too much on way too little. So, yeah, I pretty much gave the same rant again. But it's I want this to be positive. I want this to be something that I'm happy about, and I am happy. You saw the landing too, I assume.
Yeah, I saw the landing. Sorry, there's some ice cream coming through here. It's
oh, wow.
I can't really do anything about it in the location where I'm at.
Well,
just 1 second.
Yeah,
he's passing by. He's passing by.
Uh huh. No, Kyle, we both know.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I did watch the landing. I saw Curiosity.
All right.
The first pictures that they got back and the excitement and everything, and it was really a thrill.
Yeah,
seeing all that stuff work.
It was very emotional. The moment when they actually found out that it had landed, it was on the ground. My God, I had tears in my eyes, as they all did as well. I was just, these guys are the true heroes. I mean, the Olympic athletes, yeah, great, but these guys really are the heroes, and they need a ticker tape parade. They need to be shown as much as any military hero, as much as any athletic hero, that they are indeed determining the future of humanity and doing some really, really incredible and positive things.
Yeah. I think they're worthy of it, and I think you'll see some more support for them and other projects like that.
Uh-huh.
But it's so true. They're getting information in real time, and you know they would learn one thing went well, and there'd be a little bit of size, but still tension. And then when they finally got the pictures that it was there on the ground, and then they had photos that included the wheels of it, you know, hitting on the surface and stuff, that they were really sure that it had been a success. So
yeah,
it was really good television, and no screenwriting or any kind of scripting necessary. I mean, that's real life. It was so dramatic and very beautiful.
Yeah, one thing, Matt,
I know, quite an achievement for science and explorers everywhere.
Right, exactly. One thing you can never accuse NASA TV of being is overproduced. And just watching these guys, it was like, you know, being in an auditorium at your high school or something like that. It was, you know, as awkward and geeky, but it's still, that made it all the more real. And you really felt like this is what it's all about in the end, you know?
Yeah.
So, okay, I don't want to hold you. I know you're busy out there in Seattle. By the way, welcome back to Seattle. I know that we're going to talk to you again tomorrow night on Off the Hook about the hacker camp you're on the way to in the next couple of days. But maybe just give us a very brief synopsis of what's coming up.
Yeah, that's going to be tricky. Right around the time Off the Hook airs, we'll be in Nia Bay, and we'll be looking for a way to call you either on the internet somehow, or perhaps we'll find a landline telephone in that part of the world. Either way, we'll need to be finding a way to give you a call and check in. And basically, we're heading about 4 hours from the Puget Sound area to Nia Bay, which is the very, very tip, the very northwest tip of Washington. And if it weren't for Alaska, it'd be the very northwest tip of the U.S. But, of course, Alaska is much further up there in the northwest.
It's a very northwestern tip of the continental U.S. How's that?
I guess that's safe to say, but I'm going to be going out there, and there's going to be about, I think, around 1,000 hackers and people, enthusiasts of all types, camping and sharing. I think there's one track of talks for 3 different days, and there's going to be a cooking competition, I believe.
And it's something involving
all kinds of activities and art installations, spectacles, and Yeah, basically just thought of nature, too.
Well, so. something involving a laser, too. You want to tell us about that now?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, so if I haven't already said it, Hackerbot Labs is just a space that I work at, as it were. They're basically working on a light installation, which is basically going to consist of 24 1-watt 450-nanometer laser diodes. And what that means is we're taking, like, four laser diodes that are 24 of them that are all sort of in an array, and we're going to turn all of them on, and we're directing that beam up directly straight up into space, and we had to get permission and all sorts of clearance for the airspace, and basically it'll be a solid column of blue, verging on black light, if you know what it's like to walk around with in a nightclub under a UV lamp where everything sort of glows. It's going to be that kind of color, but it'll be about the diameter of a 50-cent piece or a dollar. That is how thick this laser beam will be, and it's going to go up into the air in the shape of a cone. So that's about it.
Will Curiosity be able to see it?
Yeah. We're going to make the laser light safe to look at, which helps with thousands of campers and stuff. And yeah, it will be projected straight up into the sky, and hopefully people will be able to see it from quite a distance away.
Okay, I don't know if you heard me, but I asked if Curiosity would be able to see it. Is that a little bit too much to hope for?
Yeah, from what I've heard, the shape of the beam is going to be a cone shape.
Uh-huh.
So there's a vanishing point at around, I think, 4,000 feet, which is much lower than I thought. I thought we were going to go up higher. And, in fact, some of the calculations the FAA used before we were working on this were incorrect and made correct by our project. So just getting the altitude for those sort of things right is tricky in and of itself. So anyway, we're topping out, I believe, at 4,000 feet.
You're saying the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, got it wrong and a hackerspace corrected them?
Yeah, there's a blog post about it. It's pretty funny.
Oh, boy. Funny or scary? I'm not sure which.
Yeah, they've been using the same calculation since 1994, and it worked out so our beam was, you know, safe after 14,000 feet when it wasn't safe after 400. Or it was something ridiculous. But, yeah, the correct height will be about 4,000 feet, I believe. I think that's correct. So.
Okay, cool. Well, we'll talk more tomorrow on Off the Hook, but... it sounds great. Sounds like a lot of fun stuff is about to happen over there, and it's just kind of a cool time of year, I think, with a lot going on. We have the conventions to look forward to, the political conventions, and the whole election season, and all that kind of fun stuff. And of course, we'll be covering all that here on USB and Off the Wall. Any parting remarks, Kyle?
Oh, I'm terribly. Sorry to be in such a hurry and frazzled. I'm packing and very, very busy, so I'm a little bit out of sorts today. But please, I thank you for having me on the show, and please catch up with me again. I'll speak with you again, I guess, tomorrow.
Okay, great. Well, have a great time out there, and yes, we'll be in touch and keep our eyes to the sky and work
like
that.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
All right, take care. And, of course, the voice of Kyle, who was here in the studio last week and is now back out in Seattle and on his way to tour camp, the second tour camp. The first one was in 2009, and that's an outdoor hacker event in the United States. Next year, there will be an outdoor hacker event in Holland. And, we basically have these traditions now going on. We have German hacker camps. We have American hacker camps. We have Dutch hacker camps. And, of course, we have all kinds of conventions and congresses and various other things. So, yeah, it's something to follow, all of this. Okay, now, where were we? We were talking about Mars and NASA, and I was talking about how scientists very often tell us things that we don't want to hear. And there's one particular NASA scientist that is saying something that a lot of people refuse to hear. What do the 2010 heat wave in Russia, last year's Texas drought, and the 2003 heat wave in Europe have in common? Well, all are examples of extreme weather caused by climate change. That's according to a new study from NASA scientist James Hansen. This is not a climate model or a prediction, but actual observations of weather events and temperatures that have happened, he wrote in a Washington Post opinion piece, which was meant to accompany the study. Our analysis shows that it is no longer enough to say that global warming will increase the likelihood of extreme weather and to repeat the caveat that no individual weather event can be directly linked to climate change. To the contrary, our analysis shows that for the extreme hot weather of the recent past, there is virtually no explanation other than climate change. Yeah, that's pretty damning words there from somebody who I would imagine knows what he's talking about. It's amazing to me to see people basically accusing scientists of having an agenda. You know, what agenda would that be exactly? Why would scientists want to make people think that that climate change is a reality, that humans are screwing up the environment? What would be in it for them? I always like to pursue these lines of questioning, and I never quite get satisfactory answers. Continuing with this story, the study, which was published by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, looks at the past six decades of global temperatures and finds what Hansen described as a stunning rise in the frequency of extremely hot summers. And, you know, this is one of them. This summer has been unbearably hot. This winter sucked. There was no winter. I'm not sure if that's all related, but boy, it sure seems like it might be. But, you know, I'll listen to people that actually know what they're talking about. All I can do is theorize. The study compared what is happening now to what was happening between 1951 and 1980. Get this. In those years, extremely hot temperatures covered less than 0.2% of the planet. 0.2%. Now, those temperatures cover about 10% of the land area. That is one hell of a rise. 0.2%. That's less than 1%. That's a fifth of 1%. And now it's 10%. You know, that had better make you stand up and take notice. The study dismissed the idea that specific weather patterns are by themselves sufficient to explain today's extreme anomalies. Phenomena like La Niña have always been around, but large areas of extreme warming have only come about with climate change, the study said. The odds that natural variability created these extremes are minuscule, vanishingly small. To count on those odds, this is good, to count on those odds would be like quitting your job and playing the lottery every morning to pay the bills. Yeah. Hansen directs research at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York and is a longtime environmental activist. Aha! Aha! There's your agenda right there. He's an environmental activist. How can you be an environmental activist and a scientist at the same time? Well, you know what? I think if you are a scientist, you kind of turn into an environmental activist because you actually see the data, you see the facts, you run the experiments. And you can't get any more unbiased than that, as far as actually gathering the data. But the people who believe that global warming, climate change is a myth, they most definitely have an agenda. Their agenda is increased profits, not having any oversight when they pollute the waters and the air, being able to waste fuel and just live their lavish lifestyles at the expense of other people and the environment. That's their agenda. That's what they get out of it. So, you know, we should look at that. Let's look at that first when we weigh the two sides. Because the two sides are not equal. You have one side that has facts and another side that has emotion and the desire to maintain the status quo. All right. So, you know, pay attention to science, folks. It really is pretty important. We can learn an awful lot from it. You don't have to cut ties to any other beliefs. But when you ignore science, when you pretend it doesn't exist, then you just basically are condemning yourself to a life of backwardness. All right. What else shall we talk about? Interesting editorial Did we talk on this show about the badminton scandal? I think we did. Basically, where the badminton teams of several countries were playing to lose in the Olympics, and they got kicked out because of that. There are people actually who think that's not a bad idea, including this writer, Sam Borden, who wrote for the New York Times in an opinion piece. Now, Abby Wambach, he says, the veteran forward on the United States women's soccer team, said the other day that no one gives you anything for finishing at the top of your group. Which I guess makes a bit of sense, talking about the group stages of a tournament. You basically go on to the next round, but the second place team does as well. So you don't get anything special for that. Now, the goal of every Olympic athlete, from Wambach to Usain Bolt to Ann Romney's horse, Rafalka, I'm not sure if the horse really cares, but the goal is supposedly to win a medal. The rest is just a journey. So, why the uproar over the tactics used by the four women's badminton teams that were disqualified for trying to lose their final preliminary round matches? Where exactly did the badminton players veer off into corruption? They did not organize the tournament. They did not arrange the draw. They simply looked at the information that was presented to them, looked at their ultimate goal, and went in the direction that seemed to have the best chance of leading them there. A loss in those matches, they decided, would give them a better path to winning a medal. Oh, boy. Yeah, a loss would give them a better path to winning a medal. How is this different from, say, a swimmer who coasts to the wall in a preliminary heat, or a runner who jogs past the finish line in a semifinal to conserve energy for the final? Is it even that much different from a baseball player bunting? Well, Sam, you know what? It's very different. It's very different because in none of those cases is the individual making the team lose. They're basically changing their mode of play to contribute to a win. You bunt, it's called a sacrifice. You're sacrificing yourself as an individual so that another individual can proceed and score and win the game. It's not like everybody deliberately strikes out so that they can lose the game. You don't see that in baseball. You don't see swimmers get out of the pool and not finish. You don't see runners that turn around and go the other way. If you saw that, then you'd have a good comparison. But in this particular case, we saw entire teams trying to lose and using the excuse of the way the tournament was set up. I don't buy it. Sorry, I don't buy it. You know, a win is still a win. And when you're playing a game, regardless of how many games there are, period, a game should be played to win. Otherwise, you know, look at the New York Mets. What is the point of them otherwise? I mean, why bother? Why bother even trying to win? Every season, they're in fourth or fifth place. But they try. They try to win. The last game of the season, it doesn't count for anything. But they still show up. They still make an effort. And with this kind of attitude, why bother? And when you have a world watching, when you have people who have paid to go into the arena to watch supposedly the best players in the world, you owe it to them to give them something back. Not to think of the bigger picture. Should you be thinking of your retirement account and how many games you could possibly play? And, well, if I play this number, then I think it'll be a better payoff for the endorsements that I'll sign on to later on in life. No, you don't think that way. Any coach will tell you. Why am I speaking like this? I'm speaking like a sportscaster. Any coach will tell you that you play every game to win. At least every decent coach will. Anyway, I could go on reading this. It's basically justification for what they did, and you're not going to convince me. Sorry, just not going to. It was a shame. And, you know, what really upsets me is that the first thing that the people at the Olympics said was that they're not giving any refunds to the people, the poor suckers that went to that match, or those matches. It was more than one match. And now you didn't see anything. You just saw people being idiots, but we're not getting refunds, even though you didn't get to see an actual badminton game like you paid to see. So that's just sad. Other than that, you know, the same kind of negativity towards science, I notice also being aimed at the Olympics. And you can say all kinds of things about how the Olympics are run, and there's certainly a lot to fault the organization and the commercial endorsements and all that. But you cannot ignore the athletes, the people that really put their all into it, the Gabby Douglases, the Michael Phelps, the people like that that kids emulate, look up to, realize that they can be something amazing. And if not amazing, at least pretty damn good. Or at least just giving an effort for something. And that's always worth it. That's always a worthwhile endeavor. And that's what I like about the Olympics, is focusing on the individual. Of course, watching NBC, you might have a tough time because they still insist on doing it in the most ridiculous way possible, not having any live coverage, and showing just basically highlights. You know, somebody said, and it's another one of these little statistics that turn out to be true, that the Mars rover is giving more up-to-date information coming from Mars than NBC is coming from London. I think it's a 14-minute delay from Mars and, a six-hour delay from London? So that's something to keep in mind. Now, here's another cheerful story here. A freelance photographer for the New York Times was arrested Saturday night while on assignment with two reporters who were conducting street interviews in the Bronx. Yeah, but you didn't hear about this story unless maybe you were reading the New York Times. The photographer, Robert Stolarik, 43 years old, has worked regularly for the Times for more than a decade. He was charged with obstructing government administration and with resisting arrest. He was taking photographs of a brewing street fight at McClellan Street and Sheridan Avenue in the Concourse neighborhood. He was taking photographs of the arrest of a teenage girl about 10:30 p.m. when a police officer instructed him to stop doing so. And I can attest to that. They do tell you to stop, even though they have no right to. Mr. Stolarik said he identified himself as a journalist for the Times and continued taking pictures. Now, the difference, when you're a journalist for the Times, you actually have those press badges that are so hard for the rest of us to get, and which the NYPD uses as reasoning to lock you up because you're not a real journalist. Well, in this particular case, look what happens to a real journalist, somebody with credentials. So as he continued taking pictures, a second officer appeared, grabbed his camera, and slammed it into his face. That's according to the photographer. Having seen such behavior, I find it very hard to doubt. Mr. Stolarik said he asked for the officer's badge numbers. Now, I've seen people do that. I've seen people ask for badge numbers, and the second they ask for that, they're thrown in the back of a van, taken away, because that's the worst thing you can possibly do. And they never find out the badge number either. And usually they get charged with some kind of a crime. Obstructing government administration, or resisting arrest, or they just make things up. I've seen this time and time again. I'm not saying I know for sure what happened here. I wasn't there, but I can attest to what I have seen. And it sure does seem to track. Anyway, he asked for the officer's badge numbers, and the officers then took his cameras and dragged him to the ground. He said that he was kicked in the back and that he received scrapes and bruises to his arms, legs, and face. The police department said in a statement that officers had been trying to disperse the crowd and had given numerous lawful orders for both the crowd and Mr. Stolarik to move back, but that he tried to push forward, inadvertently striking an officer in the face with his camera. Well, okay, if they say it's inadvertent, I'm sure he's going to say it was inadvertent, too. So you can't treat it like it was a deliberate act. And I've seen the way police move crowds back. They basically push crowds into themselves, creating an impossible situation where there isn't enough room for people on the sidewalk, and people fall into the street, and then they're arrested for being in the street. I don't know if that's a tactic or that's just incompetence, but that's what happens. The police said that Mr. Stolarik then violently resisted being handcuffed, and that in the process, a second officer was cut on the hand. A video of the episode taken by one of the reporters, who was with Mr. Stolarik, shows Mr. Stolarik face down on the sidewalk beneath a huddle of about six officers. Clearly, he had the advantage. He was then taken to the 44th Precinct Station, was released at 4:40 a.m., always a wonderful time to be released. On Sunday, he checked himself into the New York Presbyterian Hospital for x-rays. Later, he said he had no broken bones or internal bleeding. George Freeman, who is a lawyer for the New York Times, said the episode was especially distressing because the newspaper had been working with the police department since the Occupy Wall Street protests last fall. You recall that's where some journalists were denied access to certain areas or were arrested, and they were trying to find ways to prevent the police from interfering with journalists in the course of their work. Freeman said this is an incident where it seemed the photographer was doing his job, taking photographs, and the police overreacted and attempted to intimidate him and block him, leading to his arrest. And the cops face no charges, but the photographer does, and he has a court appearance in November. Yeah, that's Justice American style. And what else, Justice American style? Well, yeah, you know, we're not going to focus on this because we don't have very much time, but we had another shooting. Another mass shooting, this time at a Sikh temple in Wisconsin. With a semi-automatic handgun used in the deadly attack. And that apparently was the same type used in other recent U.S. mass shootings, including the one at the theater in Colorado. And the attack on Gabrielle Giffords, congresswoman from Arizona. So I asked the question. You know, we claim, we as a country seem to claim that guns are needed for self-defense, and occasionally they are used for self-defense. And guns are used for hunting. Great, you know, these are all wonderful things. Yeah, sure, whatever. But when is a semi-automatic gun necessary? Show me a news story where a homeowner needed a semi-automatic handgun to defend his house, where that was what it took. And a simple handgun wouldn't have done the job. That's what I want to see. And if we can't find evidence of this, then we ask the question, why do we feel we need to arm our population with these devices? What possible use? I see the use for people who want to take out a lot of individuals. I see that. Generally not the type of thing that law-abiding citizens want to do. You might fool yourself into thinking that if another law-abiding citizen decides that he's going to take out a whole lot of people and you have one of these semi-automatic guns, that you can stop him. You know, I've never heard of that happening. You can arm every man, woman, and child with a semi-automatic gun, and I still think the element of surprise will work to the advantage of the person who starts shooting first. So, why do we need these things? Not saying, why do we need guns? You know, keep your handguns, your rifles, whatever you feel you need to protect yourself. Fine. Let's not even have that argument. But let's agree that it makes no sense to make this kind of weapon so simple to get. And wouldn't we be better off without them? And, you know, I'm open to being educated on this. If people can tell me what specific use these guns have proven to be. Because the only use I've seen, other than for law enforcement, the only use I've seen is for massacres. That's where they seem to be used. And they're calling the thing that happened in Wisconsin an act of domestic terrorism. Yeah, no kidding. Every time this happens, it's an act of domestic terrorism because it makes people afraid. Terrorism is defined as the systematic use of terror, especially as a means of coercion. But in the international community, terrorism has no universally agreed, legally binding criminal law definition. Common definitions of terrorism refer only to those violent acts which are intended to create fear and are perpetrated for a religious, political, or ideological goal. Well, you know, we saw that with the temple shooting. We certainly saw that in the Arizona shooting. And explain to me, please, someone explain to me why this Jared Lee Loeffner guy, who shot a congresswoman and killed a bunch of people that were attending her gathering, how is he not defined as a domestic terrorist? He's not. He's defined as mentally imbalanced. Guarantee, if the guy had an Arab name, we would not really care about his mental state. We would call him a terrorist. But because he's a white guy, now he's mentally deranged. Come on already. We have more domestic terrorism in this country than we're caring to admit. It's just not the kind that we want to have. We want to have the kind where the foreigners are the bad guys. But we really have the kind where the people who were born here are the bad guys and are acting out against those people that we're trying to portray as the bad guys, those evil Mexicans or those evil Arab people or whatnot. So we need to make our definitions a bit more fair. And, yeah, you know, let's consider the use of these semi-automatic weapons. I think the most common reason I hear is, well, we'll need those when the revolution comes. Enough talk already. Let's start having the meetings for the revolution so we can start planning how it's going to work. Until that happens, I think it's all just a bunch of nonsense. And people just want to collect weapons. It's not healthy, and every single week we seem to see another instance of that. All right, you know what? I'm tired of talking. I'm tired of talking and feeling a bit patriotic, too. So I'm going to go out with the national anthem. Oh, the new national anthem. Maybe you haven't heard it yet.
Guns.
Hey, Pa!
Guns.
We'll see you next week. OTW at 2600.com. That's our email address. Good night.
Hey, Pa!
Take your gun. So, come on, take it. If you can.
Hand it over. You'll be dead before you can draw the hammer back.
That's so.
Good shooting. Very good shooting.
Where'd you get that?
Come on, stay back and hold two shots. Now who wants the second one?
Well, you know music. And you can count. Bravo. All the way up to two.
Drop your gun, sir.
Don't do it. He killed Sal, but we got four guns, and he's only got one bullet left in that derringer.
One's better than none.
We got him.
Yeah, that's true. Count to three. All the way up to six, if I have to. Maybe faster than you. One.
When I say three, draw. One.
If you say two, I'll kiss you.
He counts two.
Gee. I'll kill the next man who speaks.
Gosh, what excitement. Fight!
Wait a minute. Good shooting. No,
don't shoot again. That wasn't Bill, that was me, Jingles, and don't break for that door again.
Stop him here.
Thin air. There's something downright weird about this whole thing.